Retrial hearing for Leo M. Frank comes to close. The Atlanta Constitution, Thursday, the 30th of October, 1913, page 1, column 1. Luther Rosser concludes argument by bitter attack on juror A.H. Hensley and witness Jim Conley. Judge will announce decision next Friday. Hearing of argument for new trial was one of longest in legal annals of state, lasting 7 days. The hearing for a new trial for Leo M. Frank came to a close at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. At 9 o'clock Friday morning, Judge Roan will announce his decision. It was reserved at the close of the final session in order for the judge to consider a number of legal points and to permit both the defense and prosecution to make certain changes in documents filed with the court. The hearing concluded with a brilliant speech by Luther Z. Rosser, associate counsel for the defense, which occupied the entire day. He dwelt chiefly on legal questions and cited many court decisions. He attacked the evidence of Jim Conley and assailed Solicitor Dorsey. The detective and police department also came in for a liberal panning. Harry Scott of the Pinkertons, who was an active figure in the Fagan investigation, was likewise flayed. Rosser's bitterest words, however, were employed in assailing the 12 jurors who took the word of the Negro Conley in preference to a white girl and two white men. Says he is losing money. During progress of his address, Mr. Ross declared that he was not being paid a fabulous sum to represent Frank, as he stated many people were wont to believe. Instead, he asserted, "I am losing money. Money is going out of my own pockets to defray the expense of this man's defense. It's not the money that's in it. It's my heart and soul that moves me to fight for him." The conclusion of his argument was stirring and eloquent. "Nobody in Georgia has a more profound respect for the people of his state and county than I," he spoke. "And I believe that no matter what they now think, they will soon realize the unspeakable mistake that has been committed. No matter what else there is in this case, my own individual conviction is that Frank is innocent, and as long as there is a shred of hope, I will stand in his defense. It matter not what befalls me. Believing in Providence as I do, I am convinced that time will rectify all things and work toward final good. The failure to deny this man a new trial will be a judicial mistake that will cause the trial of the future to be held at the point of bayonets and loaded rifles. Your Honor cannot afford to make that mistake. Justice is at stake. Let us do right even though the heavens fall." Attacks Juror Hensley. He opened the afternoon session with an attack upon Juror Hensley. "Did Your Honor take notice of Hensley, the juror of the ventriloquial voice?" he began. Hensley was either an intentional liar or just a careless one. "I may live to be 100 years old, but I doubt that I'll ever see such a remarkable document as Hensley's affidavit. In the first place, a talking machine isn't in it with Hensley. He was the mouthiest person who ever sat on a jury. He would talk to anybody about anything and under any circumstances. It was a pity indeed that his words were the fume of the venom and bile that was forever being generated in his system. Hensley swears to one thing and then to another and swears both are correct. How are you going to get around a thing like that? When Your Honor sees Hensley as I'm going to paint him, not as my friend Dorsey has painted him, why, you can either take Mr. Hensley or let him alone. Why, when Hensley went to Albany after the verdict, he held a veritable reception among his friends, rejoicing over the fact that he had found Frank guilty. That is proved by his own affidavit when he says a number of friends saw me in such and such a place and congratulated me. This was the most indecent act ever attributed an allegedly decent white man. In the name of fairness and justice, are we going to stomach such as this? Can this man Hensley be the good, irreproachable person Dorsey was alluding to yesterday? Would you believe Hensley? Now tell me something. Would Your Honor, under these circumstances, believe Hensley if he came to you and said your daughter was sick in Carrollton when, just a moment ago, two other men had told you she was sick in Forsyth? I hardly think you would. I know I wouldn't. It would be better to do it all over again and let him have a new and fair and impartial trial than to let this Hensley's besmirched character dirty the laws and judiciary of our state. Enough about Hensley. It makes me stick every time I think of him. But something about Conley. That's the most horrible thing of this whole case. Nothing Your Honor did was more harmful to Frank than to permit the admission of testimony as to perversion. Look at its effect on Hensley, who said he believed Frank was a pervert and that he had come to that conclusion by the evidence. The only evidence on earth was Conley's miserable tale. I am sure that these three alleged acts of perversion which Conley relates alone convicted Frank. When this Negro's word found lodgment in the jury mind, there was left no more room for any thought of innocence, and that's the truth of the conviction of Leo Frank. There was a time in Georgia when a fragile little girl, as pure as the wing of a dove, would have been believed against a filthy Negro whose character and conscience is blacker, continued on page 9. Page 9, column 4, continued from page 1, then his skin. In that time, one little girl would have been believed against a whole caravan of black brutes. But the little Kern girl got on the stand and repudiated Conley's lie, and her story was belittled by the jury and solicitor and the whooping crowd. Believed Negro's word. They would rather believe the Negro's word. They took it in preference and, in believing it, put the nasty brand of liar on a sweet little white girl. Oh, how times have changed. I hope to God I die before they change any worse than this. Was that all? No. This jury of brave and fearless knights, courageous and unfrightened, sat in their seats and announced to the assembled city that the little Kern girl's story and that of Mrs. Levy and Mr. and Mrs. Selig were lies in the face of the filthy Negro's reeking tale. Away with Miss Kern, they cried. Away with Mr. and Mrs. Selig. Away with Mrs. Levy. Away with Anglo-Saxons. You are corruptors, perjurers. And these 12 good men and true wrapped their arms lovingly and tenderly around this stinking black brute, saying, "We love you, Jim. We love you. You have furnished the altar around which we shall worship, Jim," they told him. "This girl, these Anglo-Saxons are liars all." All of which shows that this case was the most marvelous that ever happened. It was the most outrageous. It was the cruelest. By the grace of God, it will never happen again. The close of the Frank hearing marked the end of the longest hearing for a new trial in the history of the South. It lasted exactly 7 days. 4 speeches were delivered, 2 for the prosecution, and a like number for the defense. The entire thing was held in private in an anteroom of the state library. All disclaim attacks. At the opening of Wednesday's session, Solicitor Dorsey, who had made some rather spirited allusions to attorney Rube Arnold, who was associated with the defense on the previous afternoon, arose to say that he meant nothing personal in the attack and that he regretted the fact that his words had been so construed. Mr. Arnold, who was present, followed Mr. Dorsey to the floor, saying that he had not been concerned over the remarks and very graciously declared that he had not considered them personal. Attorney Rosser, smilingly, spoke up that he wanted to be declared in on the peace conference. "Nobody must think," he said, "that we lawyers in such an extraordinary case as this should take matters as calmly as a bride takes her flowers." Page 1, Column 3. Pythian Knights Plan Fine Home. $5,000 of stock already subscribed towards erection of building, which will cost over $50,000. According to plans formulated by the semi-annual meeting of the various lodges of the Knights of Pythians embraced in the 5th Congressional District at 2 sessions, held Wednesday afternoon and evening in the lodge room, sin the Kaiser Building, the local lodges of the order will soon erect an elegant and commodious home in Atlanta. Although the plans are yet in their infancy, the preparations made last Wednesday night for subscriptions to the stock for the construction of the edifice are indicative of a magnificent modern building to cost not less than $50,000. The afternoon session of the Knights was devoted to the routine business of the order, the disposal of the various matters which have arisen during the past 6 months, and the election of officers for the coming year. Russell Smith, honored. The officers elected at Wednesday's meeting are Russell K. Smith, President, Newman Lasser, First Vice President, W. G. Moore, Second Vice President, Young H. Frazier, Secretary, Leon C. Greer, Sergeant at Arms, Ray Frank, Inner Warden, and Wallace Rhodes, Chaplain. These officers were elected for a term of 1 year each. The session of Wednesday night was a most enthusiastic one from every standpoint, each speaker declaring himself in favor of the immediate erection of an Atlanta clubhouse for the order and being cheered to the echo for his stand. The principal speakers of the evening were Mayor Woodward, who delivered the welcoming address, Shepard Bryan, J.W. Austin, Hamilton Douglas, Frank Hooper, and Russell K. Smith. Mr. Austin's address was undoubtedly the most interesting and entertaining of an excellent program, for while the speaker, in his inimitable style, caused uproars of laughter by his unique anecdotes, there was an underlying current of loyalty and deep feeling for the Pythian Brotherhood in his speech that touched a responsive chord in the heart of each and every member of the large crowd of knights who were present. Home is necessary. Our order stands for everything that is good and righteous, and every true Pythian endeavors to live up to his oath and teachings, said Mr. Austin. The time has come when we have reached the stage of development where a commodious and elegant home, worthy of the noble order in order which we are all brothers, is an absolute necessity. We all know, and it is unnecessary for me to state, that the Knights of Pythia stand for the sacred observance of everything good and holy in the lives of each knight and his family. There is a movement on foot throughout the country to compel a thorough physical examination of an all applicants, both men and women, for marriage licenses, and our order was one of the first to advocate such an examination and fitting physical qualifications. In pursuance of the good work that our order is doing and will, by the grace of God, continue to do, it is fitting that we should have a suitable meeting place where the members of the knights, particularly the younger ones, can meet in comfortable good fellowship and discuss the high ideals and purposes of the organization. Building is necessary. Therefore, we are gathered together with the main purpose of formulating plans for the erection of a building that will be not only adequate to the present needs of the local lodges, but he will be able to accommodate the new and increased membership that we are bound to acquire within the next few years, and in addition, be a credit to the beautiful and enterprising city of Atlanta. A charter for a $50,000 company for the purchase of a suitable lot and the erection of a lodge building has already been secured, and the work will be started as soon as the necessary subscriptions can be secured. More than $5,000 was subscribed to the stock of the company at Wednesday night's meeting in shares of $100 each, and it is hoped to secure the entire amount within the next few weeks.